Okay, I'm here with Cameron McEwen again. Our first recording got cut off at the 53-minute mark, and Cameron was just going to explain something that people are not familiar with, researchers are not familiar with, the NAEB. So what were you going to say, Cameron, about the NAEB and what we learned in that, those files?
Right. So you bring out the importance in 1971 of his conversation with Father Peyton, where he says that the medium and the message run together, and it's not clear where one is differentiated from the other. And what this means, in effect, is that the whole idea of a medium is not yet clear in McLuhan's mind, or maybe it's maybe it was too clear before, and now it's become appropriately unclear. But at any rate, that's 1971. But what I wanted to bring out was that already in 1959, just a year after he began saying the medium is the message, which was first came to him in the early part of May of 1958, when he was at UBC, and which he then repeated at some length at a conference in Washington, D.C. later that same month. And that conference in Washington was where he met Harry Skornia. And by the way, since our last conversation, I've checked with people that knew Harry, and the pronunciation of his name was Skornia,
okay,
not Skornia.
All
so
right.
We're settled with that. Anyway, so he then in 1958 began a very intensive correspondence with Harry. And anybody who knows the communication that McLuhan had with various people knows that his communication could become compulsive. He might start writing every single week at a time when letters had to be stamped, and you get them to the post office, and it's a much more cumbersome procedure than what we now have, but he would do it. But his correspondence with Harry trumps all that. Sometimes he would write Harry three or four times in a week, and some of his letters to Harry are 12 pages, 15 pages, 18 pages. And Harry would, there's one letter where Harry writes at the start, he says something like, what's the point of such a long letter? Right? How do we use something like this? And then at the bottom of that same sheet, there appears to be McLuhan's answer. McLuhan's answer was something like, writing letters is a way of getting at new stuff that can be developed later. So a letter isn't something where you inform somebody what you know, what you're doing, and all that sort of stuff. You're kind of reaching into the future and finding stuff there that's a little bit indistinct, but you're putting it down on paper to help bring it into a useful distinction.
Yeah, let me say this. Let me say this, Cameron. That is the role of the letter in finding its wake. It's the ground. The way you're talking about is what Joyce was doing with the letter.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, letter being a component of the word, and the word being a component of a letter.
Yeah.
Right? And so this becomes very involuted, especially for Joyce. But at any rate, when McLuhan was doing all of this correspondence, what he was doing was filling out this idea that we don't know what media are, and therefore we have to begin exploring it, right? So one of the things that I think people don't understand about McLuhan is when he talks about the coming together of art and science, he has a very advanced view of science. Most people think science, well, there's people in the lab and all that sort of stuff. But for McLuhan, his ideas are actually on science are actually quite close to those of T.S. Kuhn. And Kuhn distinguishes between normal science and revolutionary science. And one of the things that characterizes revolutionary science is that everything that normal science does becomes more or less meaningless and has to be recast. And naturally, this only can be done by great minds, and it also requires a kind of social component that makes it possible, because somebody can have great ideas that might revolutionize science, but those ideas can become lost or they can become delayed. Catholic priest who had the idea of genes and how they work wrote all of his stuff, I think, in the 1850s. And three or four different people independently discovered his stuff in the first decade of the 20th century, 50 or 60 years later, and then genetics grew out of those discoveries. But for 50 or 60 years, it had been completely buried.
Mm.
So what McLuhan tries to set out, what McLuhan is grappling to set out, is what do we need to do in order to found the science of media that might be, right? He doesn't know what it is. All he knows is we need to get there, with scare quotes around there, because the destination is unknown.
Yeah, I just want to say that Kuhn's book comes out in 62. So Marshall's, he's not being influenced by Kuhn. He's just delighted when he reads it a few years later. It confirms what he proceeded to have used science as.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know this for sure, but it's possible that I was the person that brought Kuhn's book to McLuhan's attention, because Kuhn was my advisor in my junior year. And I was reading Structure of Scientific Revolutions in very detailed fashion with Kuhn in, that would have been 1964-65, so
right.
just after the book came out, right? So then when I met Marshall, I emphasized to him that I thought his work had a lot to do with the work of Kuhn, and then it didn't go any further.
Didn't you meet him in 70?
Well, the more I think about it, the more I think it must have been in the fall of 68.
Right, because he has it in Counterblast.
Maybe. I don't remember that he has it there. I know that around 1970 it shows up.
Okay, we can check that. But the what university are you at when you're with Kuhn?
Princeton.
Princeton, okay.
Yeah.
All right, you might get that credit.
Well, I'm not too interested in that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, what McLuhan is setting out in these long letters and stuff, and remember that NAEB, the E is educational, right? National Association of Educational Broadcasters.
Yes.
So McLuhan had been casting about in the 1950s for how he was going to find an audience. And he had more or less given up on a literary audience, and he didn't know enough for a technological audience, and he hit upon education as the area where he might make his mark.
Right.
And so this tied back into his thesis on Nash a decade before, which had often been about education. The history of education for 2,000 years, you might say, is one of its main topics. So in the middle 50s, he begins to lecture a lot, and to at the Columbia Teachers College, and to publish essays in the Teachers College Journal.
Yes.
And so by the end of the 1950s, he's known as an educational theorist, and one who is grappling with issues that everybody knows about but didn't have a handle on.
Mm.
So the whole disconnect between teachers and their students, and the whole disconnect between what we're educating our students for and what the real environment is like out there. So McLuhan is doing a lot of lecturing to educational associations, to English language teachers association, on and on.
That's when he meets Neil Postman, I think, late 50s.
Could be.
Yeah.
That I don't know about. But I do know that when he's talking about education, as he was in May 1958 in Washington, the conference was on education and new media, was sponsored by NAEB and by the Office of Education of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And those two sponsors of the May 1958 conference would be the two people that funded and guided his Project 69, which started the next year. So he meets Harry in 1958, end of May, and right away the two of them realize that they can put together a project that the federal government might fund. And I set out the background of this at my blog, so I won't talk about it much. But during the 1950s, the educational folks were trying to get more money out of the federal government, and they hit upon the idea of making education grants part of the defense funding, because it was far easier to get money for defense out of the government than for education.
Mm.
So they worked at that most of the decade, and they finally succeeded in 1958. So just at the time...
Well, wait, he just... who's they? Who succeeded in 58?
Who succeeded in doing this? There was a rough coalition between certain senators, certain Congress people, the NAEB, certain universities, and they were lobbying the federal government in various ways to try to get some, it's minuscule money for the Defense Department, but it's huge money for educational research.
Mm.
So they, this coalition finally got some millions of dollars, right? Peanuts in the defense budget. Millions of dollars were going to be dedicated to research in education of new media. And that got passed in 1958. So McLuhan and Harry realize immediately that they might be able to ramp up McLuhan's reputation as a theorist of the educational use of new media to get money. And so in 1958, in the fall, they're putting together a description of a project, which then was finalized in January and February 1959, and approved in May of 1959 for a start in September 1959.
Yeah.
So all this time, for my purposes, all of this history is sort of background stuff. The important stuff occurs in McLuhan's letters to Harry, because at just this time, McLuhan is at what I consider to be the top of his game.
Mm.
In 1959, he's going to start to have his blackouts. 1960, he's going to have a near-fatal stroke. All of the 1960s and 70s, he's sick in various ways. So in 1958, 1959, the time of all of this correspondence, he's able to reap the benefit of the previous 2.5 decades of thought and investigation and get them on the record, you might say, but not as a finalized product. Get it on the record as questions to be looked at.
Mm.
Right?
Yep.
And especially the question of, if it's possible to have a science of this stuff, how do we need to go to realize that science? And what he emphasizes to Harry is that in order to get new ideas, what you have to do is juggle ideas. So you juggle ideas, you talk about them, you write about them, and you continually sift them, and you're looking for that moment when the safe clicks open.
Yeah.
Right, as he later describes it, right? And so that's what McLuhan thinks he's doing in Project 69, is trying to define the conditions of beginning rigorous investigation into these huge questions of education.
Right. Now, you relate that to the discovery of the elements or something, in 1800, and McLuhan's
absolutely
looking for the elements or media.
Correct. That's my view, yes.
You want to just say a sentence or two about that? I don't know if we said it already.
Well, I'll just say that, in my view, what McLuhan was aiming at, and some of this is described in the correspondence that we're talking about, what he was aiming at was a revolution in our thinking about the humanities and the social sciences that would be analogous to the revolution that happened after 1800, once people began to intuit the structure of elements, chemical elements.
Right.
So that what he emphasizes to Harry over and over and over again, and which is strangely absent from most McLuhan research, is that McLuhan says the marker of making progress in this sort of stuff is that there will be no difference between what people do in school and what they do out of school. And what he means by that is, if somebody's doing freshman chemistry, that's not a different chemistry from what General Motors or Dow Chemical or anybody dealing with physical materials is doing, right? It might be simplified, but it's the same thing, right? And so McLuhan says this divorce between the classroom environment and the larger environment outside points to a deficiency in our thinking about education, right? We need to find a way that these inside and outside are doing the same thing, right? Not to say identical, not to say dead, but they're involved in the same project, you could say. And according to McLuhan, if we can introduce students to what's going on outside, then the divorce between teacher and student, or between student's idea of who am I and what they're doing in school, these things will be revolutionized as well.
Yes. Now, is this, as chemistry deals with physical elements, is media study with memes mental elements?
Well, you see, the whole question that we're involved with here is how does language work? How do media elements work? And you can't presuppose that the distinction we might draw now between physical elements and mental elements is going to hold once we know what we're talking about. Right, so you have a long discussion of
Baudrillard.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I got it mixed up with Baudelaire.
Yes.
But what he's talking about is the failure of distinctions, right? And you sort of follow on with his talk about the failure of distinctions. And McLuhan would probably agree with much of what he has to say, because the distinction between, say, physical and mental is something that we don't know much about, because we don't have a way of rigorously investigating what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? As soon as we know what we're talking about, then the explosion of knowledge will happen, as it did in chemistry, biology, medicine, genetics, all this stuff since 1800.
Right, I got 2 points to make, maybe three.
Fire away.
Yeah, remember, the last 20 or 30 years, they've done a lot in the lab with hooking the brain up with perception or something, you know, the cognitive studies, I don't know what they call them, but the military is flying planes with their thoughts and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
That is new knowledge, and that might be getting into the finding out what's physical and what is not physical. The other point is, in the last recording, we ended with you pointing out that the Scorny discussion is the beginning of, say, 6 years, 58 to 64, where he's doing Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media at the same time, Understanding Media being Project
right.
69. So I wanted to point out that in Cliched Archetype, around a page 109, no, I'm not sure what page. In Cliched Archetype, he talks about Thomas More's, M-O-R-E's, Utopia. And he says it's Napoleon, which is made up of two books. Book one
right.
is a discussion of the medieval environment, which was receding as they moved into the Gutenberg Galaxy. So it regards the medieval environment as art form. And then in book two, the way McLuhan describes it, More explores his present, the present time, turning, what does he do there? How's it, what's it say? Turning the past into an art form, or it's a bit different from book one. Book one regards the medieval period as art form, and then book two is exploring the present to hoik up the values of the past, something like that. So those were two aspects of the Apelian of More's Utopia, and in light of a lot of utopian thinking going on in the late 50s and early 60s, McLuhan probes that, and so the Gutenberg Galaxy is studying the print world and preprint world, the manuscript world, as art form, maybe even archetype, and then in Understanding Media, he's exploring the present with the electric media. Now, when I did his archives, I found a one-pager that he had on the manuscript for Understanding Media. And it started off saying, this book treats speech as an archetype. So it's not print as an archetype, like Gutenberg Galaxy, it's speech. But that's because there's a supposed retrieval of the oral world in the electric age. So it's important to think of the Apelian, which Marshall writes about with Don Thiel in his book on Tennyson in the mid-50s, the important role of the Apelian. And he says a lot of the modernists, Joyce, Eliot, and Pound, write Apelia or Apelians. And so he's following in that mode with these huge Apelians, Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. So I want to make that point. And then I don't remember the third one, so it'll come up.
Let me talk about the Apelian for a minute.
Yes.
I can't remember in the first recording if I pointed out that Eric Havelock, while he was at the University of Toronto, published his first book in 1939 on Catalyst, and then published a long three-part essay in 1946, I think it was, maybe the end of 45, start of 46. Where, again, he talks about Apelia. So I think that the notion of Apelia was abroad at the University of Toronto just as McLuhan arrived in 1946. 1936, and that he had this notion of Apelia kind of bouncing around in his brain. And at the same time, his friend Gideon had been teaching at MIT at the end of the 1940s, and McLuhan knew about that. And through Gideon, he knew about Carl Deutsch, and he knew about all of the work on cybernetics that was being done at MIT. And he knew that the key to this work in cybernetics was the computer, and he and or what was in the process of becoming the computer, I should say, just at this time, and that the key to computation was digitality. And so you have the Apelia as a literary form, which is a always the bringing together of two different layers, you could say.
Yes.
And, which is something that Eliot was already saying about Ulysses in the early 1920s, right? And so McLuhan knew Eliot's essays very well, knew about Eliot talking about the echoing back and forth of Homer and modern Dublin in Ulysses. So McLuhan was very tuned into what was perhaps the essence of modernity in literature and the essence of cybernetics in technology. And so
right.
He was trying to think about all of this sort of stuff.
Okay, let me throw in this part. So
yeah.
Gideon is in his thoughts through the 40s. So Gideon is
right.
Like the Scornia of the 40s. And let's see, and then Hugh Kenner shows up, 46, 47.
Right.
But meanwhile, Don Thiel is at Yale studying with Wimsatt and Brooks and whoever else was there that are professors who have read McLuhan's PhD. So they've got
right.
That thinking, that going on in their head, and he's thinking about what they're writing. And Don Thiel is a student of those Klentz and Brooks. I mean, Brooks and Wimsatt. So
Wimsatt, yeah.
Don shows up in 1950 and gives McLuhan the human use of human beings or cybernetics. Can't remember which. But Don said that he turned McLuhan on to cybernetics and what was going on at MIT. Now, maybe the Gideon part or what you were saying might be a factor that Don didn't know about. So Don becomes, after Kenner has gone to, what did he go
Windsor
to?
Windsor and Yale.
He went to Yale, yes, in 48, 49.
Kenner went from Toronto to McLuhan's old job in Windsor.
Oh, yeah, in 46, that's right.
At Windsor, he then goes back and forth with McLuhan about where he should do his PhD and even if he should do his PhD.
Yes.
And the outcome of that is him going to Brooks at Yale.
Yeah, that's where McLuhan meets Pound, which is another really important connection for McLuhan. And Kenner, in his obituary appraisal of McLuhan in the National Review in January 81, he says the most important thing that he got from McLuhan on a personal advisory level was the importance of getting a PhD. It wasn't so obvious in the late 40s, but he went with that. I'm going to get a PhD because McLuhan kind of recommended it. And he said that was really important in his life career, doing
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
To supplement what you're saying. And so meanwhile, Kenner goes down to Yale, and he's going to be dealing with the same professors Thiel is already dealing with. And so Thiel comes to Toronto in 1950, and he's only 22. And he has a math background at Yale. He's also in the class with George Bush and the guys that go on to do the Skull and Bones and the CIA stuff. He knew those people in his class. He never got raided or whatever the word is. What do you call it when you raise somebody to join a frat?
Well, maybe... at Yale, they don't exactly have fraternities, but the societies that they have there, Theol was Jewish, I think, right? Probably.
No, Don's not Jewish. He's Catholic.
No?
He's Catholic.
I thought you said that he converted.
No, that's Thal. That's Nelson Thal, T-H-A-L-L, and Don is T-H-E-A-L-L.
Oh, okay. No, I know the distinction between the two of them. Okay, good. So that makes better sense to me, because I was actually going to question you about that, because it just didn't compute. All right, good. So where are we here?
We're talking about Kenner and Thiel, and you were going to say something.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that perhaps, as is true in my own talk about McLuhan and Thomas Kuhn, where I think I may have had some influence, it's probably a human characteristic to think that one might have more credit than one actually did. So I think that McLuhan was already hooked into the Macy conferences before Don showed up at the University of Toronto.
Okay, here's 2 points. We were talking about Kenner and the importance of a PhD, and Kenner thanking McLuhan in his send-off after McLuhan died for that point. But McLuhan, he meets Don. I could look at the actual letters in 1950, because I know he meets Don in June. That's when he comes from Yale. And Don's doing it to avoid the draft that was coming in with the Korean War. And so he wanted to get to Canada. But he, you'll see a letter, McLuhan's writing to somebody saying, the MIT gangs are doing stuff way more important or more interesting than the literary claques, C-L-A-Q-U-E-S. That was his term. I don't know what that is. It's cliques.
That's a letter to Pound.
Right, and he's saying that we can look up the date and see if it's before Thiel hands him the book in the mid-50s or after. That's the question, because if it's after June, then I would give Don credit for making McLuhan aware of this scene. I don't think he wasn't talking about it to anybody in 49.
I think it's a more complicated research question than that. The letter to Pound, I think, is 1951. So that would point to Don's importance in this regard.
Yeah.
But I believe there's already stuff between McLuhan and Gideon in 49. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, all that matters is, was McLuhan thinking about literature and technology together, and did that influence him or prompt him or something to think about Apelia? And the answer to that is clearly yes. There's a long description in Marchand that talks about McLuhan becoming fascinated and obsessed with Apelia around 1950.
Yeah, now it just occurred to me, he defines Apelia as explaining God to man. Now, that would be the social world and the social conflict and the pain of the human condition. That would involve technology, whereas spiritual enlightenment or whatever you call it when you're doing your spiritual quest or being a Catholic or something is not the world of the Apelian. That's the world of the epic, maybe, at least the Gnostic epic. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do, but I think you're headed up a wrong tree there, because the importance of the Apelian form to McLuhan has to do with it being a medium. Right? It has to do with the form of thinking that's going on in both literature and in cybernetics.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, that the Apelian's more appropriate to media studies than the epic.
Yes, sure. The difference between the epic and the little epic in McLuhan's thinking is the difference between the Gutenberg Galaxy and the Electric Age or the Marconi Age.
So you don't see the Gutenberg-Gaussi as part of the Abelian?
Well, here's the problem, Bob. Let's say that McLuhan is tending towards defining the elements of human experience, something like that. Then those elements don't come into effect at a certain point in time. What one discovers, let's say in 1800, when you discover, first of all, oxygen, and then you go on to other gases and stuff, you discover what was always there but not known.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the apelia, the form of apelia was always being expressed during the Gutenberg galaxy, during the rise of Greek philosophy after the pre-Socratics, etc. It's just that it wasn't known. But then the idea is that it becomes known, and once it becomes known, you have something like cybernetics.
Okay. I'll put that in consideration.
Good, yeah. We're not speaking gospel here.
That's right.
We're trading ideas.
Yeah. Okay, so we were talking about Skornia, and then I said, well, his colleagues in the 40s were Gideon, and then Kenner, and then Thiel, and he does a lot of work on finning his wake with Thiel. Didn't do that with Kenner, and he had been interested.
I'm not sure about that. I think Kenner was the guy that got him to reconsider, especially the wake.
Right.
Kenner had expertise in Joyce, unlike anybody that McLuhan had ever met.
I recall, I think, in Martian's book that Kenner said that McLuhan avoided the wake, but I'm not exactly positive about that. But the thing is, he was doing the wake with Muller Time. How do you say his name? Muller Tim? Muller Time?
Team.
And that's in 39. So that was his main colleague in the late 30s. So he is aware of the wake. He's looking at it, but he doesn't talk about it much in the 40s. He talks about Eliot, and he wants to do a book on Eliot with Kenner. And then he wants to do Lewis in 49, and he's telling Kenner or Felix. Has he met Felix yet? I don't know.
They were colleagues in St. Louis.
They met
in 42.
Right. Okay, so now he's got Don Thiel. And they have a very intense relationship. They meet every day at Don's apartment from summer of 50 to 53, when Don has to finish his PhD and he hasn't got time to answer McLuhan's phone calls in the middle of the night and all that stuff. And he's got a couple of kids, so he's got to get his PhD. So, but Thiel, that's very intense, 50 to 53, while McLuhan is also doing Pound. And then Thiel does his PhD on McLuhan's classwork, on the communication theories of Pound, Eliot, Joyce, and Yeats, not Lewis.
Right.
He couldn't do Lewis because the paintings were locked up in the National Gallery or something in Ottawa. So he thought he had to get access to the paintings. And Marshall objected to him not including Lewis. But you read his PhD. Did you ever read Don's PhD?
You know, I think I have it. And I believe I've read it, but if I have, it was like a decade ago, and I don't recall much about it.
Well, what's interesting to me, it's literally the classroom talk of Marshall. And Don was smart enough to, as a young man, to hear it and know it so he could write it. And no one else could. You talk to Murray Schafer, who was in his classes in the early 50s. He didn't know what Marshall was talking about, not the way Don was. And, you know, you see the interview with that lady who was in that period. She said that Don was the leader of their clique of McLuhan students who were into McLuhan. Barbara somebody, or Pat, Patricia or somebody. Anyways, Don is a key guy right there. And he also, as Carpenter gets involved with McLuhan, Don is the secretary for the two of them when they make their application to the Ford situation in 52, 53, the Ford grant. Okay, Now we're talking about Skornia and the medium and the message, and that's what you. I don't know. Did you finish that point about the NAEB correspondence?
No, it just it ties in with your book, and that the sorts of complications that you bring out in, for the 1970s, I believe, were already present in the late 1950s, and that
no
we
late
need four, to under-
the late yeah late 50s. That's right, late 50s.
Late 50s. Yeah, and that we need to keep in mind that those questions and difficulties are in McLuhan's mind as he finishes up at last the Gutenberg Galaxy and then transforms Project 69 into Understanding Media.
Right. Now, I've seen you say that he figured out tactility in the late 50s. And this is when he's in his prime. Is that what you mean? In the time of his prime, he suddenly gets...
I'm off the top of my head. I wouldn't want to date his concern with tactility because that's a very sort of broad question. Because as both of us know and as both of us have emphasized, tactility is a very powerful conception in McLuhan. That doesn't have much to do with touch and has everything to do with the modulations of experience. And this is something that you go into in various ways in your book. And as we go through your book, I think this is a topic that we're going to come up against all the time.
Okay, good.
All I would say as regards the dating of tactility is that he probably came to fit together tactility with his notions of the gap and resonance and stuff through an essay on the Japanese term ma, which who's the architect? Oh, Fred Thompson.
Yes.
Fred Thompson did that paper for him, I believe, in 1969.
Yeah, late 60s. I remember that.
Yeah. So it was that paper of Fred Thompson that got McLuhan thinking about tactility as the gap, as the a lot of his letters at that point in time, as you, the letters that you have put up on your site, very often they have to do with the gap or with nullity or with nothing. And on, all of these things get associated with tactility in McLuhan's mind at the end of the 60s and then throughout the 1970s.
Okay, so what is the difference of influence of Skornia as a colleague as opposed to Williams, Jacqueline Tirwhitt, Carpenter in the Explorations Group? What is Skornia adding to it? Is it just he's found his genre, his audience, educational broadcasters, which he didn't have in the mid-50s?
I think what McLuhan found in Skornia is somebody who was somehow able to relate to McLuhan without much friction.
Right.
There was some friction because the NAEB files have a correspondence between Harry and other people in the organization, and sometimes people are complaining about McLuhan, sometimes rather violently, and Harry agrees with some aspects of what they're saying.
Yeah.
So Harry was well aware of some of the difficulties of working with McLuhan, but he was able to work with McLuhan in a way that McLuhan did not feel that constrained him. And what happened with the Explorations Group is that everybody, including Carpenter, especially including Easterbrook, came across to McLuhan as constraining.
Yeah.
He believed that everybody in the Explorations Group had Gutenbergian minds, and he was very frustrated that in the 3 years of the seminar, he wasn't able to get them to see the difference between how they were thinking and what he was trying to talk about as a new sort of thinking.
Yeah.
He just regarded the whole thing as a failure by 1956.
Right, and he's also not doing too much with Don Thiel anymore either, so he's alone. So he does
Absolutely.
The Verbi vocal visual in 57, and then Lewis
right.
dies in March 57. So he's becoming a solo performer in the late 50s.
Right, well, remember, this ties in with what we were talking about earlier with the Columbia College of Teachers.
Yes.
Because it's at the end of the exploration seminar that McLuhan decides he has to find some different audience, and he turns to education theory as a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's, I think that's the background. Well, look at your notes. What else do you remember we said that didn't
well,
get recorded?
I think one point that I'd like to bring out, and I'm not sure how much got recorded or not, but at the very beginning, I talked a little bit about how we agree that McLuhan could see things that other people couldn't see.
Right.
And that this was a trait that he had his whole life long. And I like to think of it as second sight.
Yes.
And I found... partly because of your book, I found what I take to be a great example of this. So on your pages 72, 74,
yeah.
If you happen to have that in front of you, you bring out a long quotation from A Garbage Apocalypse from 1970. And you go on to explain that... you found the publication with this essay in Dennis Young's library.
Yes, the Art Critics Conference in Ottawa. Yeah.
Yeah. So then on the basis of what you say in the book, I was able to find online a PDF version of that book.
Wow.
It wasn't easy to find, but it's there. It's, and the reason it's not easy to find is it's not in text. It's only an image. So
right.
then what I did was I took the image and converted it into text, and I'm going to put it up on my blog because it's already on the Internet, and I don't think there's any rights problem with putting it up. So I'm going to put it up. And... what I found as I was doing the work to digitize this essay is what I regard as a fabulous example of second sight. And what I'll do is I'll just read you this very short passage. It's only one sentence.
Okay.
So he says, he's the section that you have in the book has to do with... percept and concept, and with primitives, and with human beings becoming hunters again.
Yes.
And it's in this context that he says the following. He says, when you are at a loss for words, you tend to resort to gestures and grunts, and like I mean, man, right? That's a quotation you could
yes.
say. Have you not, this is a new sentence, have you not noticed that language is disappearing very rapidly. Okay, so he's talking there about the how the electric world, the Marconi world, is going to replicate the Paleolithic world, right?
Yes.
But what he's talking about there in 1970 is exactly what's going to happen to him in 1979.
Right.
Right? When
That's
you are
right.
at a loss for words, you tend to resort to gestures and grunts, and like I mean, man, right? Didn't he only have one or two phrases that he used all the time?
Yes.
Oh boy,
was one of them, oh boy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right? And then he says, have you not noticed that language is disappearing very rapidly. And so here we need to say, have you not noticed, he's talking about the lecture audience in Ottawa, I guess.
Yes.
That you is first and foremost McLuhan himself, right? Have
yes.
you not noticed that language is disappearing very rapidly, right? So what's interesting about this is we can take from this some important characteristics of second sight that we always need to remember when we're reading McLuhan.
Okay, let me bring in my story about that. But the in War and Peace in the Global Village in 68, he makes the sentence about language is fading out, speech is fading out. He says that in War and Peace. What you're saying he did in 70. Okay, well that's great that you have that book. That's good. All right. In 1970.
But wait a sec before you leave. It's very important to think about what the characteristics are of such second sight.
Well, here he gives one example of one type, but remember in Take Today in 72, he's saying ESP is old hat. There's a new kind of second sight that he's probing around with.
No, old hat. It doesn't mean old in the usual sense, right?
Yeah, but then he goes on, that's the title, and then he goes into artistic awareness, prophetic, visionary awareness is obsolete. He says that in Take Today.
Right, but you see, this is something that we're going to talk about a lot in going through your book.
Okay.
Once you advance into the electric world, into the all at once, then the obsolete and the out of date and all that sort of stuff has an entirely different meaning, right?
Yes.
Old hat is completely different depending upon whether you're talking in linear terms or if you're talking in all at once terms.
Yeah, in Take Today, right? In the table of contents, doesn't he have old is new and new is old?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's how the book ends, actually, in talking about that stuff.
Yes, and then his essay in Verbi Vocal Visual 57, Electronics as ESP, he just says it blatantly there.
That's right.
So here's my story, which I said, but we don't have that part of the recording. So what happened is in November 74, he's interviewed by June Callwood, who is the McLuhan of feminism in Canada. She's a top journalist, very high profile person. You remember her, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's almost like she deserved the private McLuhan. So she comes to interview him, and he talks a lot about his kids and very personal stuff. And this is not in the article, what I'm going to tell you, but I got from somebody a copy of the recording. And in the recording, he goes on about how he has ESP. And what a problem it is. It gets in the way of his life. And he says, for example, I have a friend who's in New Guinea, and I know exactly what they're thinking and what they're experiencing. And he says, this happens to me, you know, daily. So he's actually saying to her that he's, quote, a psychic, which is something you don't say to people too much, especially in universities. So she doesn't comment on it. She doesn't develop it or explore it, and she deletes it from her article. Doesn't go into it. But luckily, I heard the recording, and he talks about having ESP. So there's that. And then it turns out in the summer of 74, I called him, and he was talking about Eric getting the essay on Finnegan's Wake in the James Joyce Quarterly. And I know that was the summer of 74 issue, and he was telling me how great it was, and it was just happening. So that means I was talking to him around the summer of 74, and I mentioned something about my diet, and he says, well, I don't think you should eat too many bananas. I was eating a lot of bananas. He says, Edgar Cayce says, that's not good. He quotes Edgar Cayce, for God's sake, or for psychic's sake. Now, you know who Edgar Cayce is?
Yeah.
The most famous medium of the 20th century, the Sleeping Prophet, he was called. But here's McLuhan, like Don said, they read this The World of Kook in the early 50s, you know, and they're searching, looking into alchemy. But if McLuhan knew he had ESP, then he would sneakily be looking into people that talked about that stuff, like Casey. So it's a big part of Marshall's life. And he actually went to the Evergreens, the very good medium in 1976 that I did for many years. So that's what, if you want to go into that, that's great as we talk.
Well, maybe, but I have a different take on that stuff from what you do, I believe.
No, I have it. I'm a postmodern on ESP. I've been developing an idea of what ESP is not the way the New Age or woo-woo people do it. I think there's a different kind of ESP going on.
Yeah. And you have that in your book, and we'll talk about that and those sections. But what I want to bring out here is that let's say that you're a researcher and you're interested in compounds that might be useful in treating cancer.
Yes.
Now, there's no limit to the things that you're going to look at for anti-carcinogenic properties.
Yes.
For example, the other day I happened to be looking at the Japanese news channel, and they had a little 15-minute feature on a woman whose specialty is the mushrooms that grow in the deep sea, like at 5,000 meters or something like this. And she goes down in submersibles, and they're able to pluck some of these mushrooms. And when they get up to the lab, she grows them, and then she tests them for various qualities, one of which is whether they have an effect on eradicating or slowing down cancer,
mm-hmm.
right? So when McLuhan is looking at stuff that's written or talked about or something like this, there is absolutely no limit to what he thinks is capable of rigorous analysis.
Yes.
Right? And just like deep sea mushrooms or something. So, right? So he doesn't look at psychics in the same way as everybody else does.
No.
He's looking at them as having the same sorts of intelligible structures that everything else does, but put together in a slightly different way, and maybe that's important for something that we need.
Yes.
Right? Like treating cancer or something, right?
Did you ever see his statement on cancer, treating cancer?
But apricot pits, you mean, or?
No. He makes a statement about cancer about 1974 or 75 in a obscure newspaper. He says cancer is a lifestyle.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
You've seen that.
That's important. That's important. Yeah. You can keep developing that if you want for the recording. But just because
well,
I happen to have seen it doesn't mean that other people need to be deprived of your wisdom.
Right. So cancer is a lifestyle, a great succinct statement of what people were starting to realize in the 70s in the cancer research. And it goes back to Hans Selye's The Stress of Life, which is really important for McLuhan. And
absolutely.
I think one of the things we talked about that didn't get on the recording was his discovery of the role of numbness, the numbing factor of technology. He says, "Why we all know, or advanced perceivers recognize, that media are extensions of our body, but we don't know why people ignore the effects of technology in the present." And he says, this is my discovery. He says it's in page 6 of Understanding Media, that I figured out it's the numbing factor. And so I guess that's Thomas Aquinas' sensory knowledge added to Hans Selye. Hans Selye is very important to McLuhan and The Stress of Life. Now, The Stress of Life becomes new media environments, and therefore diseases happen in new media environments. And he had a disease every time there was a new technology that came along from the 40s with television. And so cancer is a lifestyle. He is being a doctor saying media ecology is what medicine needs to consider. We need to have television turned off 6 months of the year because the decibels are too high, causes too much stress, and that would lead to cancer. So
yeah.
this is important.
Yeah, but it's one of the problems in McLuhan, and that is that if we just think about chemistry for a minute, imagine Priestley and Lavoisier around 1800 or 1790. They're beginning to intuit that oxygen is something to be differentiated from phlogiston, and they're beginning to see that there may be a way of defining the chemical element. And we can imagine they might be tempted to look into the future and begin to say something like, imagine if we could get all of these definitions and what it would be like around 1850, 50 years from now, and all that sort of stuff. So McLuhan often goes off into the future about changing the temperature of countries and doing this and that. And it's a kind of wild science fiction. It's something that he shouldn't have done in the sense of communication, because it knocks people away from the really good stuff he was doing to the stuff that he was seeing through second sight, but not seeing very well.
Yes. Yeah, right? That's a good point.
So there's a very big difference between how you apply science depending upon the stage it's at.
Right. Now, he makes that great science. Mysticism is tomorrow's science, dream today. I think that's in Playboy magazine.
Yeah.
That's a really great statement. And
absolutely.
He may have been confused, but he was ahead of people because that's where science is going. There's so much studying
Correct.
Of the paranormal and all that stuff now. They go into the taboo mystical areas. So McLuhan was maybe a father of that.
Well, at least, I don't like to talk about father, this and that, simply because the origin of things is always very obscure.
Yeah.
So he was at least somebody who gave thought to and made contributions to this sort of subject area. But this gets back, Bob, to the two sentences I was reading out of Garbage Apocalypse, where what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk about what McLuhan could and could not see.
Okay.
Because this also relates to numbness, right? Because I think numbness in 1964 is not only a description of what he's talking about in 1964, it's also a way of looking ahead to what he will see around 1970, having to do with gaps and resonance and nullity.
Yes.
So when he says that when you are at a loss for words, you tend to resort to gestures, right? And that you turns out to be McLuhan, but he doesn't know that, right? And he doesn't know the circumstances of, what will arise. And he doesn't know the causes. What he's saying here is he's looking into the future, and he's sort of groping around like the famous blind people that McLuhan was always talking about.
Yeah.
And by the way, so does Samuel Beckett all the time, right? So
well, that maybe gets into Joyce's influence, since he was going blind.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So here's Joyce would know an awful lot about tactility, just on account of his bad eyes.
Oh, right? Here's a side thing. You know that Joyce went to mediums a lot?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me. But remember what I was saying before about the difference between somebody who goes to medium because they're ensconced in the Gutenberg galaxy, and they think, oh, here's a medium. They deal with life and death, and they deal with communication, all that sort of stuff. That's completely different from somebody that's in the Marconi era, and they're looking into media as something that's inconceivable to somebody in the Gutenberg era.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, right.
So those are a different thing. But here's McLuhan talking about himself, but he doesn't know that he's talking about himself, right? So the question of the who in Second Sight, the who this concerns, that's always unknown, right? And when, that's another unknown. And
yes.
Where, that's another unknown. And
they're called
who,
the six
process.
Degrees of separation. Who,
there
what, when, where, why, and how.
Yeah.
Visual space.
And you can say, yeah, but what's interesting here is you can say that in acoustic space or in future space, those questions also apply, but they apply as blanks.
As what? As blank, did you say?
Blanks, yeah, as gaps.
Yeah.
As unknowns.
Right.
So he says this stuff. He doesn't know who. He doesn't know when. He doesn't know where.
He doesn't know how or what or why.
Exactly. So if we want to understand.
Oh, maybe that's what he was getting at when he says, I don't know what the difference is between medium and message. That's another part of that second sight area.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Yeah.
Okay, so what were we going to say?
To me, what we're talking about here is how McLuhan needs to be read, right? How are we to understand, or to, sometimes we have tapes or something so we can hear, but how is he to be understood?
Yes.
When we read him, when we hear him? And what you and I are talking about here is that this kind of understanding is very, very complex, because in order really to do it, you need to exercise a little bit of second sight yourself.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, then you need to back up a little ways and say, well, before I look into what McLuhan is writing or saying, I better try to figure out how you look into the future a bit. Because looking into the future a bit concerns how I, in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to try to understand McLuhan.
Yes.
Right? There's a necessary opacity there, both between what I'm doing now and what I will be doing in 5 minutes, but also to the perception I have of McLuhan, if I ever have one.
You blipped out.
No? Oh, okay. After what?
If you ever have.
Oh, had what? Had a perception.
Yeah, say that sentence again, that last statement or question.
I'm saying that there's an opacity, a gap, something that cannot be seen between where I am now and where I need to be to understand McLuhan, either through reading or hearing.
Yes.
And there's not only this gap in me, there's also a gap in what I'm going to see if I succeed in seeing it.
There's going to be a gap in what you see if you succeed in seeing.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know that?
That's what second sight involves.
Yes.
Right? Sight involves seeing, and we just were talking about how there are this series of unknowns to second sight.
You have to make a shift in your perception. You make a trick of your mind to allow yourself to know it.
Correct. But you see, that's a very important topic in your book.
Yeah.
When you say you have to make a trick of your mind, what you and your means there is not you and me, Bob. It's something very different from
that's
that.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he, when he reviews Julian James's book, he's just pointing out what James misses, the formal causality of the phonetic alphabet. But I think Marshall was fascinated with that phenomenon that James was saying people naturally experience before visual space. They were perceiving all kinds of crazy resonances, and there was no framework for it. And he saw that's what we were heading into again. But he never.
Yeah. That's exactly what the passage concerns from Garbage Apocalypse that you quote at some length.
Yes.
On 72, 74.
When he's there talking to these art critics who are very conceptual, or even, you know, there's the movement of conceptual art at that point, he's telling them that anything you come up with called concepts is not going to be appropriate. It's so blatant what he says in that, more blatant than anywhere else, about percepts over concepts in that statement. It sounds like he's crazy to those guys. They value concepts, right, and they're Gutenbergs, but the he's blatantly saying that you've got to realize there's something in communication that involves post-concept situation, which is, you're right, second sight.
Yeah.
Second sight
and
dimension.
Actually, that's a whole new meaning of second sight. So thank you very much for prompting that. You see, let's take a primitive hunter, and they're going around and they're looking at footprints of some animal, and they're trying to track that animal. They're trying to figure out how fresh are these prints, and how big is the animal, and how fast was it traveling, and all of these sorts of questions that are imperative for the hunter to understand, right?
Yes.
And McLuhan's idea is that that hunter does not work by concept. He doesn't say, he doesn't try to say, well, I know that animals of such and such a weight impress the dirt here by such and such a number of centimeters or something like that, and on and on. Instead, what the hunter does is he uses percepts. And most people completely misunderstand percepts in McLuhan. Percepts aren't something that we do. It's not something that's sort of ahead of concepts in point of time or something.
Right,
like
right.
This. Percepts are what people have already seen.
Yes.
Right? And it, in fact, includes maybe what they didn't already see, but they could have seen. And so the hunter, when he's looking at these footprints, he's flipping over in his mind all of the different ways in which this has been seen. And that includes all of the different ways that those perceptions had following perceptions of what that meant, right? And so that, I think you call this a global theater, then the so-called primitive person is doing something that's very profound, and he's doing something that is lost with the Euclid era, and it's lost in some respects to our great detriment, because
yes,
what that hunter is doing is, for that hunter, percepts are not his or are not hers. They are the common wealth, you could say, of human being.
The lingua franca?
No. They are the common heritage. You could even say the common being of human beings. Right?
Okay.
The person is not attending to my focus or my knowledge of things. That hunter is attending to all of the possible ways of seeing this and assessing this, and none of those belong to me.
Right.
The
that's
only
the
thing
medium.
I do,
that's a definition of the medium, an aspect.
Well,
of what
one of the definitions.
Right. Let me say a few things before
book,
I forget them.
Different.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I want to point out, we forgot to mention, maybe he got his first inklings of this when Carpenter reported to him his Eskimo experiences, or what we call Inuit.
I'm not for sure. I mean, look at his thesis from 19, it was published, I mean, it was accepted. It was submitted and accepted in 1943.
Yes.
It was written in 1941-42. There you have the three trivial arts, right? And
yep.
Those arts, according to McLuhan, are ways of relating to the world. They are already media, but the thing that McLuhan had in his mind from his University of Manitoba days was that in a book like Science in the Modern World by Whitehead that he studied very carefully, if you go through Science in the Modern World, you find that he refers to media-like things on almost every page. But when he refers to them, they're always named differently, and they always have different specifications. Sometimes they're mental, sometimes they're physical, sometimes they belong to an individual, sometimes they belong to a society, sometimes they belong to a civilization, on and on and on like this. So McLuhan didn't know in 1930, let's say, when he first read Whitehead, that this was a problem. But over the next 20 years, next 30 years, I should say, it gradually develops in his mind that the whole question of media is self-referential, right? Unless you've got your media right, you're never going to get your media right.
Okay, now let me add this. Remember he quoted somebody who said, poetry communicates before understanding. He liked that statement.
Correct. Oh, yeah, you and I conversed about this in email some years ago, and I have a post about it. And in fact, he says in four or five different places, usually referring back to Eliot, who made that comment sometime in the 20s.
Right.
Or maybe it was 1919. It was in the Dante essay.
Right. Now, see, in my chart, I consider the five levels as five kinds of 20th century tactility or ESP, but a new kind of multimedia ESP. And as you have been talking, I'm thinking when I said there's the mental level of elements, which are media, and the fact that in 1953, Crick and Watson discovered the particular parts of the genes, and McLuhan discovered the mimic code. The mimic would be later Dawkins' word meme. But this ESP that people have on the perceptual level of their society and the environment's influence on that, and maybe the conditioning of it, is what we're getting at. We're getting at an aspect of the meaning of medium. It's the collective ESP. And we ended talking last time, but why did one culture dress one way and another culture dress another way? You could say it's the weather or different aspects of the physical environment, but there are also the effect of the language. And language is an active ESP. And look at the tetrad for verbum, V-E-R-B-U-M, that McLuhan presents, I think, in Etc. magazine. It's one of my favorite tetrads. Do you recall that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You quote that maybe even in this book. I can't
remember.
Oh,
that's right.
But,
yeah, it's in, yeah. That's right. We look at there. But do you see that this awareness of the medium that Lewis gets into is a product of the telephone and the radio in the 20s? The medium is the message. It dawns on these people, you know, in a very innocent way, and then McLuhan develops it and applies it.
Sure. Well, McLuhan says that right out many times, that it's the development of new media almost simultaneously. I mean, if you look at world history, the number of media that were developed after 1880 or something like this is more than the number that were developed for hundreds of thousands of years. Right?
Yeah.
And this onslaught of media is one of the things that makes people look into the question, and in fact, which enables an answer to it.
Okay, so McLuhan once said that there was more invention in the 19th century than in the 20th. But let's see, that may mean hardware invention. Once you get into the radio shock, and he said radio jumped evolution a million years. We evolved a million years when we started experiencing radio compared to society before. Now, then we end up resonating in the electric sphere of radio, movies, and computers, and you get into the global theater and then the global membrane, and then later other things. But this resonating would mean no more hardware inventions, but what you have is enhancement of the ESP quality that you're trying to describe, that he had as second sight personally, but it opened him to a kind of communication between people through gesture that media extended. So he's, and that's why he says electronics as ESP. He's analyzing ESP, and he makes fun of one of the famous psychics in his 50s articles and Explorations, whatever the he was tuned into a world that people, regular scholars, literate guys, Gutenberg-Gaussi people, would not look into, would not even acknowledge. Do you know who I mean? He mentions the fad, maybe it's some psychic who talked about reincarnation or something in past lives, in one of his mid-50s essays. He just drops their name in.
Yeah. I think that was common with him. But you have to understand, Bob, that what you're talking about here is the essence of McLuhan. And, you know, when he says baseball is culture, or ads or art, or comics are going to be the new form of books and all this stuff, this is similar to what you're saying. He believed that any kind, as he said already in the 1944 article on Richards and Leavis, if a cogent literary theory has to be, what does he say? I want to use the word pleroma, but that's probably not correct. But he ends that essay by saying more or less that our theory needs to be complete. We can't have a theory that applies to, let's say, books, but doesn't apply to film.
Yeah.
Or it applies to books, but not to comics. Or it applies to books, but not to ads. Right? And so he was already very conscious of the need for a comprehensive theory in the 1940s from having worked with these people in the 1930s.
Yeah. And what are their names? Lodge and Rupert? What are the...
No. Maritain. You're thinking of, Lodge and Wright, with a W, were the two professors that were very influential on McLuhan around 1930 at the University of Manitoba. But what I was thinking about in terms of Leavis and Richards is that he had actually been working with them physically in the middle 30s.
Yeah.
Right? He was in several courses with Richards, and he was practically married to Leavis's journal Scrutiny.
Yes. Okay, so now what's interesting, all of the modernists, Eliot, Lewis, Pound, they all hung out with the Theosophists at some point in the 1900s, 1908, 1910, 1911, that scene. So they're well acquainted with that. And then McLuhan is living with a man, his father, who's fascinated with the Rosicrucian stuff. So the talk of this stuff, that I don't know if it's a minority topic, but probably it was, he had it in his house. And I don't know, was his mother psychically channeling these things she'd perform? Was she having some ability that made her quite a good, what do they call her, an elocutionist? So he lived in a very charged house on these
levels.
That's
right. Yeah. But you see, once you think of his mother, then you see that a lot of the definitions of these things needs to be enriched, right? Most people think of, let's say, channeling as something that a few exceptional individuals somehow reach across time and channel some other individual and all that sort of stuff. But McLuhan's mother, as a reader, had a business of channeling, right? And she was constant, as she was cleaning the house, she was constantly murmuring to herself.
Yeah,
really, the house was full of murmurs of English literary history.
Right. That's why he knew so many poems. He knew poems by the time he got to university that the other professors didn't know. He had a good dousing of it. He'd been dunked in it, royally dunked in it.
Absolutely.
I wonder, would the ESP side over into the quadrivium, music, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy? Would that be more psychic side than, or second sight side than the trivium?
I don't know how to answer that. I think that the second sight would enter into all of them in a certain way.
Yeah.
But I think, again, some of this is in your book.
That's right.
And we will definitely get to it. But the whole topic of McLuhan and music is a very rich one.
Yes.
One of the things that I think we talked about last time but didn't get recorded is the fact that the Muller teams were a very musical couple.
Yeah.
Right. Bernard Muller team was an accomplished violinist. His wife was near professional pianist. Her father was the conductor of the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra. So when McLuhan comes to write to marry Muller team as Bernie was dying in 1974, what he mentions with Corinne is being immersed in that musical household and learning about modern trends in music. And then when
he's saying that that's their experience with the Muller Timbs?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And then if you go back 5 or 7 years before that, in his letters home from Cambridge, he frequently mentions going to a friend's house to hear a symphony or some music or something. So it was part of McLuhan's culture. I don't know if it began already in Winnipeg or not, but certainly by the time of Cambridge, he was tuned into the idea that music, and especially modern music, was an important component of education, of being an educated person.
Yeah, let me add this point. Okay, so why do two musicians, great musicians, they're attracted to McLuhan? They find he knows how to talk their language or translate their experience. His vocabulary is useful. That's Glenn Gould and Duke Ellington. They both wanted to hang out with McLuhan. Ellington used to visit the coach house.
Uh-huh.
See, so why would a great musician want to talk to apparently a literate guy? But McLuhan was beyond the literate, and he's exactly what you're saying. He knew how to, he knew what music was communicating in
Correct.
Some way.
And that, so that relates to everything we've been talking about, because for Gould and for the Duke, if you didn't understand gaps and silence, and changes of chords and all of this sort of stuff, then you really didn't understand music.
Right.
Right. So when later on, when McLuhan and John Cage start talking, Cage right away thinks that, wow, this guy is talking about what I'm trying to talk about, but he can do it better.
Yes, and so McLuhan, you know, Cage's big book in the early 60s is Silence. And Marshall
Correct.
Makes a lot out of that word. And he says it's the unintended sounds of the environment. That's your acoustic ground there. And it's not limited to music. So Cage, as a revolutionary musician, you know, there's lots of books and essays on him. And they know, they write about his interest in McLuhan, but they don't get that McLuhan was further along than Cage in understanding the dynamics of acoustic space in a new electrified tactile environment.
Yeah, I agree, except I hate to think in terms of further along. To me, that's continuity, Gutenberg, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, but the bring it back to the nonlinear, the expansion of tactility by the electric and then digital environment is changing music, and Cage knows that. But Cage is a pedestrian compared to McLuhan. And McLuhan comes up with really important insights like why is rock only enabled in English? And he'd ask people, and they go, I don't know. He'd go, because it's measured in feet. And they go, what? He'd go, yeah, iambic pentameter. So there was the pun of dancing and feet in English that resonated with the rhythms of rock or pop music. I mean, nobody else came up with that idea. It's a brilliant wrap-up of why English dominated the musical world in the 50s and 60s in pop culture. And then what happens, you get to rap, and that's grunting. That's the music of the verbum. Follow me?
Well, I follow. I would tell a different story, but that's all right.
Okay, no. Go. Okay, you do your solo. What's the different story?
Well, you know, first off, I don't think it's true that rock is only in English. I don't think it's true that Southern Black dialect was responsible for jazz. I think
that's what Marshall says. No, it wasn't.
I know. Of course he does. Of course he does.
It was but industry. The black music did not come from Africa. Try to tell that to a black person.
Correct. And it's a very questionable assertion. But what I hear McLuhan doing there is telling a story and wondering if the people to whom he's telling the story can get a hook out of it. Is this something that you can relate to? And if you can relate to it, then really relate to it. Go into it. Try and think about it. Try and understand what's there.
Yes.
Right? If you take it as a historical gambit, then you're going to think it's nonsense, and you may be right. Right? It's like saying to people, now is the time of the end of the book. And especially people in universities or in journalism went nuts, right? And were saying, oh, you know, this is terrible and all that sort of stuff. Well, here we are 70 years later or something after he was saying it, and it's so obvious what was going on, right?
Yeah.
So
yes.
But what he was talking about there wasn't a history or a historical fact or something like that. It was an attempt to open a door. Right? Can you come through this door and understand what's going on? Right? In the garbage apocalypse essay that you point out in the book, he starts going into the phrase "where it's at."
Yes.
And says it's very important to think about this because what do we mean by at? Right?
Yeah.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Great question.
But people say it as if they know it.
Correct.
What it means, as if it's appropriate. Yeah. They say before they understand.
Yeah. You see, if he's right about percept and concept, and this is something that I think nearly all McLuhan, quote-unquote, scholars know nothing about, if McLuhan is right about percepts and concepts, we could never not use percepts. It's just that we don't know that we're using
yes.
them.
Yes. What did you know that R. Buck, a friend of Walt Whitman, who did the book Cosmic Consciousness, which once I saw in a picture of McLuhan's library, you can see
yeah,
that
he's
book.
He's a Canadian. He's a Canadian,
yeah,
that guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think he used the word percept. McLuhan made a statement that you can't find a definition of percept in French, or is it in English? I can't remember how it goes. is there's no word for percept before the word percept? You know
I
that?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay, I might be mixing up.
I can tell you what my research tells me on this. McLuhan read Science in the Modern World in around 1930, and I think he read it many times. He has two copies in the library at in Toronto, and I may have had more copies than that. Both of the copies in Toronto were annotated, not heavily annotated, but annotated. So he reads Whitehead with Rupert Lodge in Manitoba. And to my way of thinking, he reads it enough that it sort of goes into his RAM memory. And then for the rest of his life, he's got this stuff in there, but he's constantly shifting it, mostly unconsciously, as to what the hell it means, right? And he quotes and discusses Science in the Modern World many, many times over the course of his life.
He ends The Medium is a Massage, or maybe Fiore does, with the quote from Whitehead, "The business of the future is to be dangerous." Isn't that Whitehead?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
But just listen to this. Here is talking about pages in Science in the Modern World is sort of nonsense because there's so many different editions. But in Chapter 3 of Science in the Modern World, Whitehead quotes Francis Bacon. And it's from a book, Silva Savarum, that was published immediately after Bacon died in 1626. Mm. And the scholars of Bacon think that he was writing it in the 1620s. So this is Bacon as quoted by Whitehead. "It is certain that all bodies whatsoever, though they have no sense, yet they have perception. For when one body is applied to another, there is a kind of election to embrace that which is agreeable and to exclude or expel that which is ingrate. And whether the body be alterant being that which alters, or altered, that which is altered, evermore a perception proceedeth operation. For else, all bodies would be alike, one to another." Now, I'll go back to Bacon in a minute, but Whitehead then says, "Note the careful way in which Bacon discriminates between perception, or taking account of, on the one hand, and sense, or cognitive experience, on the other hand." So, here you have a definition coming, first of all, from Francis Bacon, and then discussed by Whitehead, differentiating between a percept, which is original, and which is not part of cognition, and concept, which is not original, and which is part of cognition.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
So when you're talking about the global theater, when you're talking about the Paleolithic hunter or something like this, and how the earliest of humans and perhaps the latest of humans are conducting perceptions. Perceptions are what is already there for humans if they attend it, but it's plural.
Yeah, in War and Peace, he talks about needs before concepts.
Yeah.
That the same thing?
Absolutely, absolutely. Heidegger has whole essays on what is it to need, right? What's involved in needing?
Right.
Is it only that I don't have something and I better get it? Or is it a demand made on me, right? Do I need to be somebody other than I am?
Yeah.
Do I need to communicate something that people need to know? Do I need to find what I need to communicate? Need is a very rich and difficult matter.
Yeah. But, okay, back to Buck. So I think in my memory that Buck was the first to use the word percept. Does that mean anything to you? Does that sound familiar?
Well, Buck may have used the word. He certainly wasn't the first to use it. I was just reading from Bacon talking about percepts as being original.
Well, he called it perception, didn't he?
He called it what?
Perception. Did he say the word percept?
Oh, I don't know about that, but percept was not an uncommon word, Bob, in earlier English.
Okay, so what I'm thinking of, somebody pointed out that other languages didn't have the word percept, or vice versa, that English didn't have it. So I'll have to leave that in abeyance and find out where that was, but it was an interesting point that English or literate people didn't have the word percept. Anyways, that's not familiar to you, so let's drop it. So back to Bacon. He's talking about needs before concepts, and he's using the word perceptions, right, in what you quoted.
Right. Yeah, and perception in what Bacon's talking about is what might be called original articulation.
Yeah.
Right? He says, if you didn't have it, all bodies would be the same. Right? So all bodies have an original articulation. And then as a development from this, you could say that humans have a particularly complex original articulation.
And then overlaid is social media. That's where people do become the same body.
Oh, yeah. But
I think
we'd have to be careful there because there you're using media in a secondary sense, whereas in most of our conversation today, we've been using medium and media in a original sense, fundamental sense.
Okay. Let's go into the next part that you want to develop in my book. We're doing page 40, then we jumped up to 70. Do we go back to page 10 or something? What's the next thing? And maybe check your questions there you wrote.
Yeah, my preference, if it's okay with you,
is
to go through, to me, the richest part of your book, and a very perceptive and interesting, are these pages between, let's say, 40 and 80, and maybe especially between 60 and 80.
Okay.
Has to do with all of the sorts of things that we're talking about.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's go to where you want to go in that stretch, in that section.
One of the things I have to bring up with Clinton is that he needs to correlate the page numbers and the PDF pages because any kind of talk about the book is difficult when those two things are different. But let me go to PDF 38 and see if that's where I want to go, or it could be... let's go to 38, page 38 in the PDFs. So
right,
just plug in.
I have one copy where the page numbers, they go down in order, but he has another version where there be one and two are beside each other. Then you go back over to three on the left and you get 3, 4. Is that what you're talking about?
No, just in the PDF that you sent me, there's at the very top, is the PDF page out of 189, right? There's a page number, for example, 38, and then /189. And you can change the page number before the slash into anything you want. But that number is always two higher than the number of the book.
So okay.
If you go to PDF 38 out of 189, you end up on page 36 of your book.
I see. Okay.
And he can correlate those. It's no problem to correlate them, and that would be good.
Yeah,
and let me mention one other thing that I have to mention, and that is that there's quite a few references in your book to the interior landscape. And to me, it doesn't make any sense to have references to the interior landscape as opposed to the essays in the book. Because if you have the essays within the book, then you know the time that it's being talked about. Whereas if it's just like page 42 of Interior Landscape, you don't know what essay that is and you don't know what time it is.
Well, I did that. I would have both in there. I'd give the essay and the year, say, published in 53 within a bracket, and then you'd go to page 35 in Interior Landscape to find it. And mm-hmm. That's 69.
It's not consistent, but I would say there's more references to Interior Landscape without reference to the essay than there is the other way.
Okay, I'll have to look at that.
It's not a big deal, but it's just something that would, if it were amplified, it would just make the book more easy to deal with.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll bring it up with them.
So let's say on page 36, you have a nice phrase here. You talk about, you say in the middle of the page, metaphor is a dimension of which we know nothing. You could say that's tactility in McLuhan terms. It's the interplay. Now, that's a very rich series of identifications, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. What you're saying there is that in metaphor or in tactility or in interplay, there is a gap, and you say that it's a dimension of which we know nothing, and for dimension you could even put the word nothing, so you could say it's a nothing of which we know nothing, right?
Yeah.
But as we go through these pages, you talk a lot about tactility and about interplay and all this stuff. And what's very interesting about all this is that you can see that if tactility is not one thing, and even in the same paragraph you go on to describe different kinds of tactility.
Yes.
If tactility is not one thing, then it's possible to imagine a range of tactilities, and then it's possible to imagine that you might be able to define media as that range of tactilities.
Right.
And in fact, I think you can do that.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, you know, 20 minutes ago, which you said, yeah, we're going to talk about that. You're right.
Cool.
Yeah, my chart is five kinds of tactility shifts, phase shifts.
Yeah,
five kinds of nothing. Now, I'm just looking at the quote. What does it I have here? But by analogy, that's a metaphor, there are no more metaphors possible. Is that the paragraph you're talking about?
No. Do you have your book up or?
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it. And I'm reading page 36.
Okay. Maybe we have different versions.
Oh, yeah. The number.
On my page 36, there is no quotation.
No, it's blue. It's me talking.
Yeah, it's blue. It's you. Yeah.
So where is the sentence? It is no longer even a dimension, or perhaps it's the fourth dimension. Is that what you had read a couple minutes ago?
No. I mean,
you're trying to turn into a metaphor, something that can't be made a metaphor, that sentence?
No. If you, you know, under edit, there's a find function, right?
Right.
Yeah, so look up interplay in the find function, and that should get you to the same place.
Okay.
Interplay, one word.
No, that doesn't get me there. It just takes me to other pages. So what's another word on the page, a more unique word?
Well, I mean, that's why I picked out interplay as being fair. How about oscillates?
Okay.
O-S-C-I-L-L-A-T.
Yeah, I have here, it oscillates between non-contact and contact.
Right. Yeah, that's right. What page number?
Okay, that is...
Okay, that's what I said before 36. So something screwed up. Anyway,
I was reading up above that in 36. So this part you're talking about is further down. I hadn't seen that.
But do you have a quote on 36?
Yes, I'll read the whole thing. On page 35, it says at the bottom, no longer order, signal, impulse, message. That's Baudrillard stuff, right?
I guess so, but I don't.
All these attempt to render the matter intelligible to us, but they're not going to be able to do it.
Right, but that's you. That's not any quotation, yeah.
But
yeah.
Order, signal, impulse, message in quotes. I think that's from Baudrillard. Then, but by analogy, I quote that, then I say, that's a metaphor. There are no more metaphors possible. Then I quote him saying, retranscribing in terms of inscription vector decoding, a dimension of which we know nothing, end of quote, because, next part, quote, it is no longer even a dimension, and that's in quotations, or perhaps it is the fourth dimension. See, that's all Baudrillard. Then I say, then he goes into Einsteinian definitions. And I say, but note it's, quote, the absorption of the distinct poles of space and time. And then I go, space and time are gone. More dialectics gone. Then Baudrillard says, all these attempts to render the matter intelligible to us, but by analogy, then end of quote, then I say, they're trying to turn into a metaphor, something that can't be made a metaphor because it's a dimension of which we know nothing.
Right.
And then I say, you could say that's tactility in McLuhan terms. You can't visualize it. It's not a sense.
Correct.
It's the interplay.
Right.
Now, you might say it's the second sight.
No, I wouldn't say it just like that.
Okay. And Baudrillard's
I would say that's ESP, or that's Pelian form, or digitality.
Right. What's that? What form did you say? Pelian form?
Apelian.
Oh, the Apelian.
Yeah,
the Apelian. Yes. Right. It's not a sense. It's the interplay. And Baudrillard's talking about how this interplay is very intimate. And there's not even a gap between what's interplaying, which is actually tactility, half of tactility. The other half is that there is contact. So there's the shifting. It oscillates between non-contact and contact. Nothing is separating, I'm quoting Baudrillard, nothing is separating one pole from the other. And I say he's saying that at the beginning, there's no difference between cause and effect, which is the way people think. And then I say, your thinking doesn't work anymore here. You can't even begin to say Bert is a human. Bert is the actual guy I'm saying this to.
Okay,
no, Bert.
Let's back up just for a sec.
Okay.
Later on, you say that all of this commentary turns out to belong to the visual world.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right about that. So, I mean, anybody listening to the tape, they should know that you're quoting Baudrillard and you're discussing it, but the voice in which you're discussing it is a self-conscious visual voice.
Yeah.
That you will then go on to recall. Right? It's to say that, nothing is separating one pole from the other, right? Well, in fact, that nothing is very real.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. It's the gap where the action is.
Yeah.
But Baudrillard is saying if there's nothing separating them, then there's only one pole. Right? So he's speaking out of a visual understanding.
Yep.
And you're citing it only to retract it later on.
Yes. Now, would you say Cavell doesn't get that in his McLuhan geography book?
I don't think he understands I don't think he understands the gap, put it that way.
Right.
In an appropriate way, and that is so central to what's going on in McLuhan that that just distorts everything else he's saying. He says that he knows a great deal about McLuhan. He says a great deal that is correct or interesting, but there's this sort of fundamental flaw that distorts everything at the same time.
And the way I'm writing this shows that I get it.
Give me that again.
The way I'm writing this, what we're reading here that I'm saying, shows that I get what you think tactility is.
Yes, I think so, because number one, you later retract
what I said.
What's going on here, right? And secondly, you're well aware, like, for example, a dimension of which we know nothing, you could say that's tactility, right? So he says that the nothing is an absence.
Yes.
It's what runs the poles together. And then you specifically say, this nothing is tactility. And that's exactly right. Right? So you're saying that these citations can be used, and they can be used in various ways. They can be used, for example, Wittgenstein talks about an arrow that could mean go in the other direction. Right? And so
yeah.
He says that if you want to understand arrows, you got to understand the language game, or the environment, you could say, in which it's playing a certain role. Right? You can never just say that, oh, the arrow is pointing this way, and that's the only possible meaning it could have. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
And that's what Richards and Eliot were saying about the history of poetry, that you, in order to understand a word, you have to understand the whole context, and you have to understand the richness that great poets build into the words, or at least recognize in the words, and then are able to use that richness, right?
Exactly.
So,
you got it. Okay.
Yeah. So
I'll just read the next paragraph. I say, your thinking doesn't work anymore here. You can't even begin to say Bert is a human. No, Bert's merged with technology. There isn't any Bert. I can't even address Bert or recognize when I'm addressing Bert. He isn't a human. He's a machine. Then I have a quote from Baudrillard. But nothing separates one pole from the other. Then I say, there's no initial and then a terminal. There's no start here and go there. Quoting Baudrillard, there's just a sort of a contradiction. End of quote. And then I say, in other words, it's like looking at a heart pumping. You can't follow the complex pumping of a heart. There's just a contradiction within the pumping, or what he calls, quote, a contraction into each other, a fantastic telescoping, a collapsing of the two traditional poles into one another, an implosion. And that's where Baudrillard's influenced by McLuhan, because McLuhan made the word implosion popular in his book.
Yeah, but for McLuhan, implosion is the what makes intelligibility possible, and for Baudrillard, it's what makes it impossible. So there's a fundamental confusion there.
Right. And that would be part, that's where McLuhan says communication and matching and communication doesn't happen often among humans.
Correct. Absolutely.
Right.
And for example, at the bottom of 36, the last sentence, there's nothing to connect in a tactile electric reality. As you say, that's a, as you go on to say later, that's a visual view of electric reality, because the nothing, that is to say the tactility, that is to say the implosion, is exactly what makes the new intelligibility of the Marconi era.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
A bit always has a gap. There's no such thing as a bit that doesn't have a one or a zero.
Yes.
A plus or a minus. Right? That's the very heart of computing, is that gap. And then, and so in a Apelian, in a little epic, if you didn't have the gap, you would have the epic.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you need the two sides that cannot collapse in order to have the resonance.
Exactly. And so just to say, after Baudrillard says an implosion, I say, and this is why McLuhan would say there are no connections in matter. There's nothing to connect in tactile electric reality. And then I say, so Baudrillard is redoing McLuhan when McLuhan emphasizes tactility, which can't be visualized. You can't make any dialectic out of it. But Baudrillard's updating it to the Android meme level of subatomic particles and genetic codes. It's more modern. It's more up-to-date than the technology McLuhan's using. Baudrillard is doing McLuhan, but updating it and making people probably unable to understand it because they don't fully understand McLuhan. I'm using Baudrillard to point out that you've got to figure out what McLuhan is saying, that it points to this paragraph that Baudrillard is saying. And because you don't understand McLuhan, you don't understand what Baudrillard is doing. You don't know that he is replaying McLuhan. You wouldn't know that. Nobody knows this unless you know in-depth McLuhan via Finnegan's Wake. Does that make sense to you? Sort of?
Well, it makes sense, but one of the differences between you and me is that I could never write stuff like you have here. It's more modern. It's more up-to-date. Baudrillard is doing McLuhan, but updating. To me, all of that's linear, and it's something that I hope in the course of discussing the book, and even right now, it's something that I hope to understand from you, because for me, the linear in McLuhan is a very sort of secondary thing, but you very much like the idea of updating and of
You know, McLuhan once said, I remember in September 78, he did a talk here in Toronto, and I went to it. It was a bunch of psychologists, and he actually, in the middle of it, made a moral statement. Now, they seem to have known that he was legendary for not making moral statements, and then he just said, as an aside, occasionally I slip a moral statement in,
uh-huh.
And everybody laughed, but that's what I do. I slip in a little visuality every now and then.
Yeah.
Because it is a visual medium I'm communicating in. And if you want to counter visuality effect in reading, you go to Finnegan's Wake, which can't be linearized. Can't do it.
Right, right.
Do a couple of words, but my alibi is the medium is the message here. I am going visual. It's a very distorted understanding of the present, but people like this. They like linearity, or the West
right.
does. They like linearity.
Yeah. I'll just say I understand the strategy, and maybe I even admire the strategy in some ways. But for me, when people like something, it's almost always through the use of the rearview mirror, and it's not necessarily going to get them anywhere.
Right. Yeah, I'm aware of that. See, I'm still in the cul-de-sac. I have to stoop to conquer, but I fail.
Well, we all fail, Bob.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, I want to end soon, but I want to bring up this. I don't know if I've ever talked about this with anybody, but in Mechanical Bride, he talks about at the end of the 19th century, I think he says in a kind of information overload, he implies that, but he doesn't say it, biology became a useful framing containing metaphor. Do you remember that statement?
Yes.
That's pretty important, that biology is the end of visual space, and that's the problem. You study medicine, you go to college, you get expert on our biology, But that hampers you for understanding the extended world that Lewis started to talk about, the extension of our organs. It's not biology anymore. And that might get into second sight there, or a collective second sight. So,
But why do you say that's not biology? Because I would have thought that you very much like the idea that the organic and life go together, and presumably the organic life and biology all go together. So I don't understand why you would see that as constraining.
Because it's visual knowledge, biology, you know, lungs and kidneys, and when a medical student learns the anatomy, isn't that what biology is? What is biology? Is it just nature? What is it?
Well, I mean, number one, like every other word, it's got many meanings depending on how it's being used, right? But I would say that the key to biology is the word bios, which means life in Greek. So the if some sample were being studied only as chemical elements or chemical compounds, and there were no life to it, that wouldn't be biology. It would be chemistry or organic chemistry. So once biology is being studied, that's the study of life. And there are some nice quotations that you have in your book where you almost say that what's ESP can be thought of as the working of life.
Yes. Now, the way he says in Mechanical Bride, he's pointing out that that was a condition of knowledge, Gutenberg knowledge, the end of the 19th century, before we had into this strange new world of no 6 degrees of separation. We didn't know where we were because visual space collapsed. He is pointing beyond biology. That's what I took it.
Yeah, no, that could well be the case, because oftentimes for McLuhan, the great biologist is Darwin. And so if biology is cached in terms of the origin of the species, this great linear passage that leads up to modern humans that neglects the missing link, then of course biology is going to be just another word for the Gutenberg galaxy.
Right. So, you know,
that's
that...
what had to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the number, or the year, 1900, is very, very significant for McLuhan, because you have Planck's constant is formulated that year. The interpretation of dreams is published from Freud that year. You have experiments in both music and painting, and in fact also in sculpture, that are breaking with the 19th century traditions. So what McLuhan is saying is that right at the turn of the century, in practically all fields, you have this bursting of the old mold.
The old what? Mold, yes. The
mold.
Old mold.
Yeah.
Right. Now, doesn't he say in Gutenberg Galaxy about Teilhard de Chardin that he discovers that electricity is a biological event? You remember that statement?
Yes, I think I do.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of where, either in your book or in an essay I read recently, McLuhan says something like, Teilhard got hung up on chronology.
Yeah. Okay, so I thought I had another idea, but basically Teilhard de Chardin, McLuhan very carefully gives him a kudos for pointing out that electricity is a biological event. So there it is, fitting into biology the way you mean it. It's new life. But science education treats it as a visual metaphor, a visual model. And McLuhan's main point by saying new environments are organic and alive, he's saying we're more than our 3D bodies. That's the new issue here. And then that gets into ESP, what you can't see. Oh, yeah, and the other one is the big discovery of the 19th century is the missing link or the gap.
Right.
People think it's electric. Right. It's a 20th century discovery, but it actually was already there in the 19th century.
But he nearly always says that they expended their energies avoiding it.
Yes, that's right. They were fascinated by it.
Of course it was there. Of course it was there. McLuhan would go on to say you can't possibly have a percept without it. And for the very reasons that we were just discussing, because all percepts entail tactility.
Right. So he says they're fascinated by it, and that would be the modern knowledge, the postmodern guys, they talk about fascinated with the other. So the gap is there in the 19th century, and everybody's fascinated with it, but they don't know what to do with it. So it's the other. And then they can deal with it, and it becomes a major factor in quantum mechanics or quantum physics because the electric environment has made it knowable, so to speak.
Right. And at the very same time, music is experimenting with different scales, and in painting, painters are experimenting with different chromatics. And all of these gaps are entailed.
Right. Like he says in Take Today, art tends to go toward science, and science tends to go toward art in the 20th century. That you could say that's tactility entering into the Gutenberg galaxy and its categories.
Correct.
Now, I think we're way beyond that now in our mixed media, social media.
I don't believe it beyond.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, so what am I trying to say? To adapt it to your preferences, I think we've got stucker more than they got stuck 100 years ago. We got even a worse cul-de-sac. And that's what's going to lead to the collisions that are coming now in our institutions.
Yeah,
there's a major war or warfare going on. There's already been war, but we're watching this loom in the United States right now. What kind of civil war is it going to be?
Yeah.
And that brings us up to today.
Well, that's probably a good place to leave it off, and we can take that up further at another time.
Yeah, probably in a week. These are really fantastic discussions.
I enjoy them a lot, and I'm learning a lot from you, so thank you for that.
And I'm learning a little bit from you. But let's hope it all got recorded.
Yes.
Okay, so let's you hang up, and then I'll stop the recording. So great, thanks a lot, Cameron.
Okay.
Really good.
All right, Bob, talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.